Inside Security Podcast with Martin and Steve Yvette and Little Joe. News Yankee Steve giving weekly updates. Armor guy managing the microphones. Joseph's there and sparkles while the vet's in the airport. Andy Googles Microsoft on his iPhone. A family-friendly bucket full of southern goodness. What will they be ranting about this week?
Hello and welcome to the Southern Fried Security Podcast. It's episode number 175. I am your host, Joseph Sicoli, and I am joined this evening by our man on the scene, Mr. Steve Reagan. Steve, how are you doing this evening?
I have the cyber pathogen. I am weak and weary after my travels to the West Coast.
And you also hear there Mr. Andy Willingham. Andy, how are you doing tonight?
Can't complain. Weather's nice, so I'm happy.
Yeah, the Capital Weather Gang here in the greater D.C. area has declared spring officially here, which of course means that it's going to snow next week, I'm sure. but in the meantime, I'm sure enjoying this nice weather out there. So this evening, Martin and Yvette are unfortunately unavailable. Martin is something covering for somebody at a thing. I don't know. I wasn't really paying much attention. But before we get started, I do want to give a quick shout out to Risky Business. Congratulations on winning Podcast of the Year from the Security Blogger Awards at RSA. We couldn't have lost to a nicer guy.
Now, wait a minute. Before you go any farther, let me tell you, brown nosing to Risky Business is not going to get you on their podcast when Martin kicks your butt off after this glass comment.
I'll have you know, I've already been on Risky Business, so there's that. All right, so jumping right into it tonight, because we have a bunch of stuff that we wanted to cover. First things first, Steve, you were our boots on the ground at RSA. How was it? Impressions? Anything that really jumped out at you?
First of all, if you've ever been in a small part of a city where 40,000 people just happen to be milling about, it's a very interesting process when you're trying to lug camera gear around. So that's always fun. When you're tripping on someone coming down the escalator, it makes for a hilarious Monday morning. So I noticed, first of all, it was a typical RSA. You know, the show went well. There was no major incidents except for the bomb scare on Thursday, but we'll leave that conversation for another time. It was a good show, but I noticed a lot of the vendors seemed to have a very common theme this year, and it kind of freaked me out that, I didn't feel wowed. There was no real true innovation or anything, except for maybe one or two products, like really new or unique out there. It was all the same stuff, but they ratcheted up the FUD and the hype behind it, which kind of made me a sad panda, if that makes sense. So, to give you an example, stop trying to make NAC happen. It's not going to happen. DLP is only useful for certain things. It's not going to save your whole network. And just because you have a nice little blinky box does not mean that, hackers are going to stop knocking on your door. It doesn't work that way. But yet, that's all the sales, pitches were basically surrounding around. But what made me twitchy, and I heard this on Tuesday afternoon, and I swear it stuck with me all week, and it made me just angry. And I'm going to share it with you two so that you get angry with me. Next generation advanced persistent threat. There you go.
A next generation
advanced persistent threat. Yes.
Huh.
And in one occasion, it was an advanced next generation advanced persistent threat.
Next generation advanced persistent threat. I'm just trying to make sure I keep this straight so that I know exactly how angry to be. What does that even mean?
I have no idea. And I'm walking by the booth as this salesperson or marketing person was doing their in-booth, pitch or talk or whatever you want to call it, presentation. And when they said that term, I actually stopped. And the producer and camera operator that were walking with me tripped over me because, I froze, mid-step. What the hell? What did you just say? And I turned around and, there is an entire audience paying – they're in – hanging on to every word, and they're nodding up and down yes, this is what we need. And I got angry, and then I just left, and I went and did another interview because I was too tempted to just literally just raise my hand and be like, I'm sorry, can you explain that one to me, thanks, I'd like to.
Did you catch any good talks? I know you had a talk. How did it go?
So I went to one talk while I was out there, and it was mine. And that talk that talk went really well. Let me tell you, the three guys I had on stage, and I was telling Andy this before we started recording, it would have been a lot like you moderating a panel between Andy, Martin, and I. It was that much fun. And the entire audience was engaged. We had a lot of great questions. So it was a very good conversation. I'm really hoping that the recording makes it out and gets shared with the public, because it was really good. And the topic, by the way, was dealing with law enforcement in the aftermath of a breach. And we got really narrow on the focus to where, you know, a data breach doesn't – when we talk about breach, we don't necessarily mean, you know, like somebody stole your database. You know, it could be any type of security incident to where law enforcement has to be notified. So it's really important to make friends and have relationships. And how do you go about doing that? So that's where we started the conversation. And it just went from there, and it was fantastic. Absolutely fantastic.
Excellent. Glad to hear it. So I do want to kind of bring up something interesting that I noticed. I did not attend RSA. I have never attended RSA. Maybe someday I will. So far, I don't feel like I'm missing too much. But what I found really interesting in reading some of the recaps and seeing some of the press releases that came out was that the Department of Defense not only had a pretty significant presence there, as did most government agencies, that's not particularly surprising. What I did find interesting was that the Department of Defense announced a bug bounty program. Now, Steve, you had some pretty interesting thoughts on this one. Here's the article I pulled from Fortune, but that the Pentagon said that it would invite vetted outside hackers to test the cybersecurity of some public U.S. Defense Department websites as part of a pilot project next month. And it's the first ever. They're calling it, quote, Hack the Pentagon.
So I was trying to talk with the mic muted. And pro tip, doesn't work. Bug bounty program, when it came out, it's interesting. I think it's a great idea. But we don't really know a lot about it, so I'm a little confused as to why they're announcing it now when some of the main aspects of it still haven't been worked out. For example, in the press release, they actually tell you that details and rules are still being worked out, but the competition could involve monetary awards. Okay, that's great, but if you don't know scope, you really can't start a bug bounty program. You know, one of the first things you have to do is figure out what exactly you want tested, why you want it tested, and how far you're willing to go to achieve the test. You know, it's not as simple as just throwing something up online saying, come get me, I'll give you a quarter. That's not how a bug bounty program works. It can take a long time to set this stuff up. So, well, I give kudos to the DOD to getting this on the road. I really think they probably should have ironed out a lot of those little details first before making the announcement public.
Now, do we have any thoughts on them announcing that during RSA? I thought that was an interesting time to choose to announce that. But at the same time, it kind of makes sense being as how you can tap into the RSA press cycle.
Yeah, that was straight up spin. That's all that was. It was no better time. You've got everybody in security is paying attention to security at the moment. May as well drop that on them. And if it goes south, you know, let's say it wasn't well received, which it was. This was, you know, quite a talk on the floor. And then it gets buried in the news cycle. So you really don't have anything to lose by bringing it out either. So they were smart.
Excellent, excellent. All right, so I want to go ahead and shift gears because we had some really interesting discussion before we started recording, and I kind of regret not just pressing record and getting it. I wanted to talk a little bit about spear phishing because it's been in the news a lot lately. We're seeing some really targeted phishing attacks, and Steve, you actually wrote about this on CSO Online. Do you want to go ahead and kind of break down what you've been seeing and the story there?
So it's no secret. Anybody that knows me knows I love socially based attacks. And what we have is a human created security problem that requires humans to actually solve. There is no technological answer to this. Since the beginning of the year, there have been a number of companies who have come forward with data breach disclosure notifications. And all of them have two common themes. The first is what's called a BEC, or business email communication or business email compromise, which is a very focused form of spear phishing. Okay, so the attack, the breach that they're disclosing started with someone pretending to be an executive or a senior officer within the company. The other common theme is the data being targeted, W-2 information. Now think about this. What's on your W-2s? What could a malicious actor do with your W-2 information. Now, the biggest jump, and actually some of the breach notifications that have gone out, tell, you know, the employees that have been being notified, you know, file your taxes immediately. That way nobody can file your taxes for you. That's smart advice. But the one type of attack they're not really talking about are 1040X. What happens if somebody files an amended tax return on you? And keep in mind, they have your W-2s. Online, a couple of popular marketplaces that I lurk on, right now people are selling not only W-2 data, but the last 4 years of a person's tax returns. So what happens with this data when you get it all combined? It's a very serious threat to individuals, and companies are being caught blindsided by this. So going down the list, you've got, you know, two companies that the public will know almost immediately, Snapchat and Seagate, okay? But you also have Central Concrete Supply, Mercy Housing, Magnolia Health Corporation, Brightview. There's been so many, I'm forgetting some of these names, but there have been seven in less than 2 months. Seven companies. The size goes from, you know, small business to large, massive enterprise. And the MO is always the same. Someone pretends to be a person in authority. They request this tax information, and they get it. And the reason why this works is because it's a very personal attack. This is not a blast an email out. Sometimes these attacks go over, you know, five or six email exchanges. You know, this could take days to get the information out, but eventually the information does go out. And that's why it stays so low under the radar. And the problem is the people performing these attacks, they're not dumb. They use paid webmail services from legit hosting providers that are more often than not whitelisted by most, you know, perimeter defenses. They almost always spoof someone in authority and a top executive in the company. So where do they get this information? Well, in most cases, the victims have actually provided that information thanks to public records, social media. It's all freely available. And then you just send a couple of generic emails like, hey, how are you? You know, get a conversation going. And then you start bringing the victim in. And once you get that trust established and they think you're who you're spoofing, then you have them. And the attacks themselves, it's not that they just spoof the victim's domain. If the victim's using Outlook, they spoof the way Outlook looks as well. From the, you know, the profile image that sometimes comes across to the signatures and everything else. And then, of course, before, when you would see these types of attacks, usually your instructions are always in like an attachment or a PDF. Now it's just a part of the message. It's a part of the conversation. You know, it's not something that you have to really push for. So victims aren't really expecting to be blindsided like this, and they just comply with whatever they're being asked to do. And of course, the big key here is they're mainly focusing on US-based companies. I'm sure this problem exists across the globe, but right now what we're seeing is a trend only here in the United States. I haven't figured out why yet, but I'm working on it. And I think there's, you know, aside from basic tax fraud and financial fraud, I think there's a bigger endgame here in the fact that the United States keeps a lot of personal information on employees that really probably shouldn't be collected anymore. I mean, people have been arguing for years that we don't need Social Security numbers, but in every instance so far, a Social Security number has been compromised. Well, that Social Security number is a key to your basic identity. Why are we still using that? So, yeah, there's more to the story, but so far as it's been developing, there's been a lot of damage done just by a very clever email. No zero days, no vulnerabilities, no exploits being hit on a browser. It's just an email.
I forget who the company was, but sometime last fall probably, it might have been a little earlier than that, we talked about a story where a company in the Plains area, you know, Nebraska or something, I forget how much they lost, but their CEO, they were working on a big deal with a Chinese company of some sorts, and the CEO was going on vacation, and I believe if memory serves me correctly, he posted something on either Facebook or LinkedIn, and then somebody crafted an email, sent it from his personal Gmail account to the CFO and said, you need to transfer, you know, 600,000 or I forget the number, you know, to this account because this has to do with this particular, you know, I mean, they had detail after detail after detail of this stuff that was going on. And the guy just, you know, he just knew there was no doubt this was a legitimate email from the CEO for him to do this. And I think they ended up doing two transactions and it totaled like 1.4 or something. Mm-hmm. You know,
I remember that.
But yeah, but that's the kind of stuff we're seeing is people are, even if they're not going and posting things such as, hey, I'm going on vacation, there's so much stuff happening on, even on LinkedIn, that is really too much. And, you know, and I was, like I was saying before the call, you know, I've probably gotten 30 or 40 LinkedIn requests in the last, you know, 3 months that I'm 90% sure these are not real accounts.
They're not. It's part of the recon effort. They literally do use, they will create fake profiles and they will go through and map the structure of a company so they know who to target, how to target them, and when. This is not a fly-by-night phishing kit type of attack. This takes a little bit of planning. And for the amount of effort these criminals are putting in, the payoffs are huge. Huge.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, when I first went to my current role, I didn't update LinkedIn. I just put, you know, financial services company. And then one day in a flash of ignorance, you know, I changed my profile and I put on there who I'm working for. And, you know, and I noticed an uptick, you know, not long after that. And this has been a couple of years ago, you know, but yeah, it definitely, you know, there's benefits to having that information out there on LinkedIn. You know, if you're really interested in networking and, or, you know, more specifically, you know, having recruiters or other companies, you know, come to get you. But anymore, the risk is just getting too much.
So I talked to one victim, and I haven't written this or published this because I really don't want to, I don't want to make them the focus of the story. I want the story to be the attack. But when they were doing their IR, they looked through their logs for the IP address of the GoDaddy account where these emails were sent from. And they started noticing a quick pattern. And what was interesting was the very first email came from the contact form on their website. And then, you know, the salesperson answered some pretty basic questions. And that's when they started noticing, looking at the logs, you know, these emails coming in. Well, it turns out that contact form email, the reason why it was used, the going theory right now is they weren't sure how the naming convention worked on the company's domain. So they had somebody email them. And that gave it up right then and there. And then because the headers showed that they were using Outlook, getting OWS access wasn't that hard. See where we're going with this? They were able to actually map and make it look like, you know,
uh-huh,
from the custom email signature, you know, with the company's logo and everything like that, it all goes in there. It all looked legit and above board. It took them several emails before they got it right. But these emails weren't suspicious. These emails were sales questions, engineering questions, requests for product demos, you know, meeting, like go to meeting requests, things like this. I mean, these are average business transaction type of communications. Nobody's thinking about those. And look at your awareness trainings. How many awareness training programs do you know of that start with the basis of don't trust your fellow staff members? Not a one. That's not how it works. And essentially, to deal with this type of threat, that's the kind of awareness program you're going to have to run. Don't trust anybody. So what I'm advocating for is you need to empower your employees. When somebody emails you and it looks like it's the CEO and they say, send me the W-2 data, call them on it. Empower your employee to pick up the phone and say, hey, did you just ask for this? Well, no. Then why? I've got an email. We got a problem. Or checks and balances. Before data like that, you know, sensitive company data, before it could be emailed out or transferred to somebody, make two people sign off on it. And it's probably best if one of those belongs to your IT team or your security team. Let them look at it. Check it off. If there's any doubt or suspicion, follow it up. If it's a legit request, nobody's going to mind answering, you know, a couple of more additional emails. The only problem is a criminal will answer those additional emails and do whatever they can to convince you that it's legit. This is not a problem you can solve easily. And I think that's the biggest part of the problem.
This strikes me as, I guess, as I hear more of the story and more of the bits that are going into it, it almost strikes me as a very kind of old school phone call social engineering style attack only moved over towards email instead.
It is very much a long con. This is not the short sell. This is a long con, and they're willing to put the effort in.
Well, and along those lines, did anybody see? I can't remember where I saw this. I saw a video the other day where a reporter for one of these media websites did an interview with a girl who's a social engineer. And she called his cell phone provider and not even pretending to be him, but pretending to be his fiance, I believe.
Girlfriend. Just girlfriend.
Yeah. Was able to reset his password, you know, and I know that stuff goes on all the time, but you just don't see it, you know, like that. And it's really, really scary that not only with something as targeted as spear phishing, but just as simple as picking up the phone, sounding cute and being nice.
Well,
it can get you what you.
So the video we're talking about, by the way, anybody who's listening, I do believe it's Motherboard. And if you look at this on Twitter, that's one of the video he was in. But the another real clever thing that happened on that call, if you remember, Andy, what was she playing on her computer? What was the background noise?
Had a baby crying.
Uh-huh.
Wasn't it?
She created a false sense of urgency and an embarrassing situation for her. So on the other end of the phone, a customer service rep who has been trained to take care of the customer, to be courteous, to be polite, to be helpful, to be friendly. This situation is awkward for both of them, so the customer rep is going to fall back on their training. Let me get you off the phone by taking care of your needs right here and now. Training in that situation is still going to lean towards doing what the customer or the caller requests. It's not focusing on security. Point in case is the story I wrote like a year or two ago when I had somebody take over my GoDaddy account and all he needed was Photoshop and a phone call. But it worked because customer service reps aren't trained security people. They're trained people. They're here to take care of us, to help out. And that's, you know, frankly, for me, I don't think it's their job to do security. I think, you know, there should be some checks and balances to where, you know, they could still be helpful but lower the surface a little bit. But people will always be our weakest link. But these types of problems are people-created problems, and only people can solve them. This isn't a technology thing. And I think that's where a lot of companies are getting their, you know, get caught with their pants down. They expect them to be a tech solution or a box or a software add-on or something that would stop this, and it doesn't exist.
Well, excellent. I think at this point... Well, let's go ahead and we'll jump into one more topic real fast. And that is that we've seen kind of an uptick recently, or two particularly high profile, interesting backdoors in some software recently. We've seen one for Linux Mint, and then we've seen one most recently this past weekend in Transmission, which is a BitTorrent client for Mac OS X. And I know, Steve, you've kind of written about this a bit. It's interesting to see kind of this uptick. I don't know that I had seen any particularly big backdoors like this recently. And particularly interesting was that these are two, you know, both of these, obviously Linux Mint being its own distribution, and then Transmission, neither of those are Windows targeted. So this is an interesting sort of backdoor in software that's usually a little less common to see this in.
Yeah, we'll start with the Transmission one, since that's OS X. First of all, it's not common to see malware towards Mac. And, I mean, it's happened before, but this is the first time you've seen, like, a live-type working ransomware attack. And that's kind of what makes this story special. But the interesting thing about it is the malware itself, when you take a look at its guts and see what it's doing, is, first of all, it was signed using a stolen key. It's a holding company in Turkey that owned it. you've got the aspects of the code itself. So it waits 3 days before it contacts a C2. And then once the control server responds back, that's when it starts encrypting things. So why wait 3 days? You know, the running theory is that this was possibly a a development thing that got left in, or they truly just kind of wanted to remain undetected. But either way, because they added that 3-day gap, anybody who downloaded this backdoor installation file transmission, they're not going to have much to worry about, because Apple's already taken care of the problem. They revoked the certificate. Transmission has done a fantastic job reacting by not only pulling the booby-trapped files, they've gotten a hold of pretty much everyone, and like, they've made a big fuss over this. You know, like, please update your software. I don't think there's any infected systems out there anymore. But even if they are, because of what Apple did, it can't encrypt your system, so you're safe. And then there's the other aspect, and people are hitting on this later this afternoon. I noticed some stories on it. The malware itself had code in it to target Time Machine and any attached device, your backups. But that code was commented out. It wouldn't work. So why leave that aspect out if, you know, you've got it ready? So there's a lot of questions around this, but it's definitely, you know, because of Apple's actions and the way it was detected, this entire malware family is going to have to be re-engineered, because there's no way now that they can get away with releasing just a basic modified version of this.
Well, excellent. I think that's as good a place as any to wrap up for the evening. As always, if you want to see show notes, I'll go ahead and I'll track down that video and make sure that that also goes in the show notes. You can find show notes at southernfriedsecurity.com/175. If you want to get in touch with us, you can always find the podcast on Twitter at @SFSPodcast. You can find me at Jay Sokoli. You can find Steve at SteveD3, and you can find Andy sometimes at Andy Willingham. And I think just like that, we'll call it an evening. So good night, everybody.
Good night, y'all.
Night, everyone.